There must be something about God that loves a scoundrel, because the book of Genesis is full of them. Over and over again, Yahweh chooses deeply flawed people to fashion the people of God. And of all the tarnished biblical heroes, Jacob must be one of the worst. Before the story that Maggie read this morning, when he has that beautiful dream, what he has just done, he's actually fleeing from his brother who has threatened to kill him. And the reason is that Jacob is a trickster, a con man, a crook. He takes a simple bowl of stew and cons his starving brother Esau out of his entire inheritance. And then, as if that isn't enough, he disguises himself to fool his dying father out of the blessing that was intended for Esau. I mean, this man, why would God choose him to be the father of the 12 tribes of Israel? What was God thinking? There are the many Jacob stories stretch over 11 chapters. So it takes him a long time to come to Jesus, as we might say. I want to focus on the chapter 28 and 32, which are the two times that Jacob encounters the God of the dark. This summer, many of us read Barbara Brown Taylor's Learning to Walk in the Dark, and she says in her book that we need to spend as much time learning about endarkment as we do enlightenment, because some of the best things that happen to us happen in the dark. And this is certainly true for Jacob. So the second time we meet Jacob in the dark of night, it is 20 years later after his dream. He's been living with his uncle Laban, who is a scoundrel in his own right, and he has become Jacob's father-in-law. True to character, Jacob has double-crossed Laban, conned him out of his livestock and his daughters he sneaks off with in the middle of the night, along with Laban's household gods. Now Jacob is about to meet Esau again. 20 years have passed, and he is terrified that his brother will want to settle their old score. So he sends his servants ahead with a large bribe, hoping that he can appease Esau. Hear now Jacob's second encounter with the God of the dark in Genesis 32, 6 to 8, and 22, 30 to 33. The messengers return to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him into flocks and herds and camels into two companies, thinking, well, if Esau comes to one company and destroys it, then that other company will be left to escape. That same night he got up and he took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. And he took them and sent them across the stream and likewise everything that he had. And that night Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip pocket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. And then the man said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then the man said, "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." And he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved." And the sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. And therefore, from this day on, the Israelites do not eat thigh muscle. Hear the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, I love the book of Genesis. I have to confess, I love blood and guts and fairy tales too. But to me, Genesis is about very real, very flawed people with extremely tumultuous family lives who are having an ever-evolving relationship with God. Now, until recently, we've thought of Genesis primarily as a story of patriarchs. But scholars now tell us that the reason for that was that the stories of Genesis were written down late in Israel's history during the monarchy, when they were chosen and sort of slanted to support the male power of the king. So more recently, we've been getting scholars who are unearthing the stories of the women of the Bible, like Sarah and Hagar, Rebecca, and Rachel. But Genesis can also be seen as the story of siblings, because they are very much there. In fact, it can be seen, for instance, not to neglect sisters, but as the story of brothers. You have Abel and Cain, Abraham and his brother-in-law Laban, Isaac and Ishmael, Jacob and Esau, and Joseph and his many brothers. Now, I want to focus today on brotherhood, what it means to be a brother, and what that means for our relationship with God. For family dynamics shape us in ways that we can never fully understand or leave behind us, no matter how much we might like to. Even if we live far away from our family and rarely connect with them, we still struggle with the dynamics of those first relationships on a daily basis. We don't often think about how those relationships might impact our relationship with God, but they do. In the faces of our siblings, we see another who is like us, but different. And those differences sometimes are so close to who we are. I mean, it's the people that are the most like us, that we love the most, that we also have the most trouble getting along with. Have you ever noticed that? If somebody is really different, then you just go, oh, they're really different. But when they're related to you and they're different, that's not so easy to put up with. And brotherhood, unlike sisterhood, has this testosterone-laden image of competition and need to win. And I need to be my parents' favorite. I mean, not that sisters don't have this too, but you really get it with brothers. And then you get that age-old question of Cain, am I my brother's keeper? And that question still haunts us today. We still struggle with that, very much so. So the story of Esau and Jacob, which was part of this summer's lectionary, brings us a deeper understanding of brotherhood and how it impacts our relationship with God. Now, already in the womb, Esau and Jacob are struggling with each other. So much so that Rebekah, their mother, or their pregnant mother, cries out, if this is the way it will be, why do I live? Well, Yahweh's answer is not reassuring. Two nations are in your womb, and two people will be born of you, and they will be divided. The one will be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. Siblings divided, nations divided, some with power over others. Right from the beginning, the picture of brotherhood is not an easy one. And then when it is time for Rebekah to give birth, the firstborn twin comes forth so red and hairy that he is named Esau, or Hairy. Right after him comes, grabbing hold of his brother's heel as if trying to pull him back and get to be first, comes his twin. So they name him Jacob, or the heel grabber, or the supplanter, the one who replaces. So already the struggle is on. Esau will grow up to be a hunter, smelling of the wilderness, and smooth-talking Jacob will grow up to be sly, with soft hands that smell of cooking herbs. I suspect that this was a conflict that was already going on at this time between the nomadic hunters and the people who were settling on the land and starting to farm it for the first time. And in this story between the two brothers, we see that this was not an easy task. Sheep herders and farmers have always been a divided people because they have different needs. And we are told very directly in the Bible that Isaac loved Esau because he loved the game that the boy trapped, while Rebekah loved Jacob. Divisions in the family. So in the reading that Maggie read, Jacob is fleeing from Laban, fleeing from Esau to Laban's,
right?
And he stops for the night. Now, I told you what Jacob had just done. He had tricked Esau. He had conned his father. Esau threatened to kill him. And he has this dream. Now, I think he deserved a nightmare. But what does he get? He gets this beautiful dream of winged angels coming down and God there saying, well, does God shoo Jacob out? I mean, he's been lying and thieving, but God says, oh, I'm going to give you the land that you're lying on, and it will belong to you and your descendants. And then as if that isn't enough, God adds this P.S., know that I am with you, and I will protect you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, and I will not leave you until I have done what I promised. What is Jacob's response to this graciousness? Well, no gratitude for him. You may have missed it, but this is what Jacob says. He has the audacity to respond with a big if. If God will be with me and protect me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to the house of my father, then Yahweh can be my God. This is not a self-deprecating, pleading prayer that you might expect. Until this moment, you can see that Jacob is not really praying to God from a personal relationship. He is praying to the God of his fathers, the God of Jacob and his ancestors. And he's telling God quite clearly and honestly, I'm going to test you, and you got to prove yourself before you can be my God. Walter Brueggemann uses Jacob's prayer as a case study in daring prayer. He says, there is here no confession of guilt, no groveling before God, no doxological flattering of Yahweh. Rather, here is bold, straightforward bargaining with God as an equal, an honest, unflinching conversation between partners, albeit disproportionate partners, but who both have a shared interest that Jacob is not timid to pursue. Jacob assumes that Yahweh is committed and obligated to him, and he is only asking for what is rightly his. This is very much the Jewish tradition of prayer, even today, to stand your ground over against God and assert the right that God will keep, your right that God will keep God's promises. By contrast, Brueggemann says, our Christian prayer is excessively submissive, soft and accommodating. We tend to assume we have no right to press upon or insist with God. Our sense of self is too humiliated, and our sense of God is too empty to pray with anything like Jacob's nerve and robustness. These days, we are more likely to pray for spiritual enlightenment and calming meditation. We want all our worries to dissolve into a peaceful oneness with the universe. That's what we expect from prayer. But in Genesis, we get a good argument with God, more than stillness with God, stillness of mind. We would do well to remember that Jesus was grounded in this Jewish tradition. We tend to spiritualize and sanitize his relationship with God as if he is praying to God the Father who has these expectations that he must be subservient to. Whereas instead, he actually, I think, prays more as if God is his beloved brother with whom he can negotiate and engage a living relationship to make it real. When was the last time you prayed like Jacob? Have you ever dared? Do you pray to a God that is shaped more by your image of a parent with expectations you're failing? Or do you pray to a God who is more like a brother that you must negotiate with and engage? Unlike Jacob, do you fear that God might strike you down if you dared to speak with honest boldness? John Sanford says, Jacob shows us how to pray. Too many prayers fail to reach their mark because people do not pray with emotional honesty. If we are angry with God, say so. If we love him, say so. If we are afraid, bring this into prayer. Now, the second time we meet Jacob in the dark, 20 years later, he is waiting and alone in fear. And something comes to him that night and wrestles with him for the night. This unnamed stranger in Hebrew is called an ish, so I'm going to stick with that word today. Who or what is this stranger, this ish? Literally, ish means man, but more traditionally, because of how the story unfolds, the ish has been identified as an angel, a messenger from God, or even God, God's self. Eli Wiesel contends that whatever else happened that night, Jacob met and wrestled with himself, with the Jacob who felt unworthy of everything he was and he had. Jacob wrestled with a lifetime of shame during that night. Now, perhaps, like me, you too have sometimes laid awake in the dark of night, struggling with worries and conflicts that we can avoid during the day by keeping busy. Barbara Brown Taylor says of the darkness that it is shorthand for anything that scares me, either because I am sure I do not have the resources to survive it, or because I do not want to find out. Wrestling is an apt image for the tossing and turning we do in the dark when our deepest fears rise to the surface. Our beds turn into wrestling mats. In many ways, Jacob is lucky, for his fear seems to take on almost physical form. For the rest of us, our nighttime struggles are filled with more amorphous ghosts that we wish we could put a face to, and a physically challenging wrestling match would almost be a relief. Who or what is the ish you wrestle with in the dark? Henry Knight says that from above or within, from mother or father, or brother or spouse or boss, it does not matter. That ish is there, demanding to be engaged. There is no turning back into sleep. The only way forward is to engage with it. And strangely, as the first rays of light arrive with the dawn, our nighttime worries seem to vanish, just as the ish needs to vanish from Jacob. But Jacob demands one more time to have something in return for letting go. And he cries out, I will not let you go unless you bless me. But before he will give the blessing, the ish too has a demand that Jacob be honest enough to name who he is, to say, I am Jacob, the one who is called the usurper, Jacob the thief, the stealer of birthrights. No, says the ish, you are no longer your shame. From now on, you will be known as Israel, the one who has striven with God and with human beings and prevailed. That night, Jacob learned he could wrestle with his shame and in those struggles meet God face to face. But transformation never comes without a cost. During the wrestling match, Jacob has been wounded by the ish. The inner wound of his shame that he could not acknowledge before is now visible for everyone to see. And that is in itself a blessing. As Buechner tells it, the last glimpse we have of Jacob, his limping home against the great conflagration of the dawn, bearing on his body the proud insignia of that defeat, which is actually a victory. The magnificent defeat of the human soul at the hands of God, our worthy opponent. God, our worthy opponent. For the rest of his life, Jacob will walk with a limp. He can never go back to being the person that he was before. His shame, like his wound, will have to be incorporated into his life from now on, and it will have to be incorporated into his walk with God. Rilke says, "Whoever was beaten by this angel went away proud and strengthened from that harsh hand that needed that person to change their shape. It is not winning that tempts a person. This is how we grow, by being defeated decisively and by constantly greater things." So if we are lucky, we too are left wounded and humbled, blessed but broken, after our night of wrestling. Perhaps as the dark fades into day, we too should dare to ask a blessing from our nighttime struggles. What a change that would be. By claiming our struggles as a blessing, by wrestling with them honestly, we may find them returned to us transformed. Whatever that hidden part of yourself that you can't stand, that you keep covered over during the day, but that comes out at the night in the dark to fight with you, God can use that to fashion your soul into a living relationship with the divine. If we claim that blessing, we too may be marked with a new identity as the one who has wrestled with God and lived to tell about it. I want to close by reading a poem that by Jan Richardson that I think is an example of daring prayer. It's called Stubborn Blessing. Don't tell me no. Remember, this is a prayer. Don't tell me no. I have seen you feed the thousands, seen miracles spill from your hands like water, like wine, seen you with circles and circles of crowds pressed around you and not one soul turned away. Don't start with me. I am saying you can close the door, but I will keep knocking. You can go silent, but I will keep shouting. You can tighten the circle, but I will trace a bigger one around you, around the life of my child, who will tell you no one surpasses a mother for stubbornness. I am saying I know what you can do with the crumbs, and I am claiming mine, every morsel and scrap you have up your sleeve. Unclench your hand, your heart, let the scraps fall like manna, like mercy, for the life of my child, for the life of the world. Don't you tell me no. Amen.